people sometimes want to do everything on their own. And you're just proving the point that sometimes you could do much bigger things and have a better outcome by learning to collaborate. I think collaboration is the key to real growth.
Yeah, I mean, and you bring up a really good point is like a lot of people ask me, how did I scale to 130 units in 3 years? It's because I surrounded myself with other people who own hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of units. Right when I got into real estate, after I made it up to maybe 3 or 6 units, I ended up finding a mentor who owned hundreds of units in the area. And rather than me asking him to be my mentor, I found ways to provide value to him.
Hey, what's going on, guys? Welcome to this edition of the Investor's Outlook Podcast. Today, I want to welcome Andrew Freed. Andrew, welcome to the show.
I am honored to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Why don't we start off the show with a basic description of who you are, what you do, and how you got there?
Absolutely. So my story all starts back during COVID when I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And before that, I more or less did the American dream. You know, I got a good education. I got a good master's. I worked at a prestigious institution. I made 6 figures. I got a swanky condo in Boston. I essentially made it, right? But when I read that book, I realized at the end of the day, like maybe I have 6 months of reserves, maybe I have 12 months of reserves, but I'm paycheck to paycheck. And that absolutely frightened the hell out of me. And I really made a decision at that point that I'm either going to go all in and bankrupt myself in, you know, 2 or 3 years and still retire in 30 to 40 more years. And that's exactly what I decided to do. So at that time, my net worth was around $250,000, $200,000 of which was in that one bedroom condo I bought 5 years ago that I completely forgot about. It literally took me 10 years to save up $50,000. So at that point, I realized the power in real estate and I took out a HELOC, a home line of credit on my one bedroom condo in Boston. And I used that to buy all of my real estate. I house hacked some properties. I joint ventured some properties. I got up to about 30 units of my own money. Once I ran out of my own money, I started raising money from investors. I syndicated a couple deals. I GP'd some deals. I JV'd some deals. And in a matter of 3 years, I built up to around 130 units.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, you brought up a good point here, right? Like you used your own money at the beginning, and then you got into joint ventures and raised money as well. Now, the landscape in 2020 and 2021 and 2020, even the first 2 months of 2022, mm-hmm. is a different landscape than today in 2024 or 2023, or even the last half of 2022. And here's what I mean. Like I had an idea of my investment firm, right? Which was Papaloni Capital. And I had the idea before I even knew what the hell I was doing. And I didn't even know how to put it together properly. So I was working a contract job at the time, you know, in with the elections. And I bumped into a few people. I talked to a few people going on, you know, along the way. I met a few people elsewhere, like outside. Anyways, I told a lot of people about this idea that I was doing. I actually had people show up to meet me and they showed up with checks in their hand. Like we're talking about checks written to a company that I haven't even created yet. For $100,000. And wow. I'm sitting there going like, I'm not even ready. I'm like, oh yeah, but take it. When you put it, you know, I'm like, it doesn't work this way. Right? Like I had to convince them to not give me the money. Let alone, you know what I mean? Usually the problem is you have to convince people to give you money. Mm-hmm. So I thought that fascinating. That's why I wanted to do it. So I said, okay, if it's that, you know, moral of the story, fast forward today, those same people, had I taken the money or even the people that I talked to, oh yeah, things have changed and, you know, with interest rates and now my line of credit, this and that. And all of a sudden that money that they were so eager to give me, they don't have anymore. So moral of the story is the investment platform has changed. Now, let's be honest. There's some people that are so anxious to take advantage of this opportunity that's out there that they're willing to double down. But there's a lot of people which are easier to find, which were their blue collar workers that are now going, whoa, hold on. That's been my experience. So my question to you is, how has the investment platform changed from you, you know, with you since the interest rates changed?
That has not been my experience. I think I closed on 100 units in 2023 at that point. So I've had a lot of success in investing and a lot of my success kind of stemmed from my brand. Like I host the largest real estate meetup in Worcester, Massachusetts, which is the second largest city in Mass. It's actually the fastest growing city in New England. Population increased 50% from 2015 to 2000 now. I also became an investor focused agent and have agents underneath me. On top of that, I was on the Bigger Pockets podcast a couple times as well. And for over the past 3 years, I consistently have put out content about real estate investing, free value to everybody. And that really set me up So when I did find nice, juicy deals, people were ready to give me money. So that has not been my experience. And even today, I have about 9 properties under contract that, you know, based on my underwriting, you know, 10, 12% cash on cash return once it's stabilized, right? So if I can make properties produce a 10, 12% cash on cash return, I'll borrow it at 6.5 all day, right? So that has not been my experience, but I do specifically focus in value add multi in tertiary markets where there is still cash flow, right? I do not try to buy in Boston and try to make that thing cash flow. It's not going to cash flow. It's 100% appreciation play, right? So that's kind of been my business model in scaling, and it has been pretty successful.
Amazing. Amazing. And that brings up the first point, because I said there's always going to be people out there that find this to be the most remarkable opportunity ever. So it's a matter of which one do you come across? I mean, I position myself to be around those guys that were using line of credits to do this. Now, their line of credits are 11%. And guess what? 11%, people aren't so willing to use it.
Totally.
So, and that's my point. That's what I want to illustrate, is that there is opportunities out there. Although where the opportunities lie has changed, they still are out there. And then you got into the multifamily and all that, which is great. I mean, you got into, and I love how you were willing to admit there that, you know, going into Boston, it's an appreciation play, and that's just not going to happen. So, you know, I mean, you're very niche in the way that you're very focused, and love that. Absolutely love that. Now, is this something you learned over experience, learned through education? Like, how did you come across this? Because, I mean, I'm sure you didn't just wake up one day and turn around and say, Boston bad, everywhere else good. You know what I mean? Like, it was just sort of, you know, this is a skill that people build up, and some people never learn it.
Yeah, I mean, I essentially did the Bigger Pockets recipe, where I read every single book Bigger Pockets put out. I listened to every single podcast. You know, I attended every single meetup I possibly could. I committed to about 3 to 4 hours of self-education over the last 3 years, which amounted to thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of education. And that kind of really cemented my level of expertise in real estate. And when it comes to real estate, there's always a spectrum between appreciation and cash flow, right? And if I'm taking money from investors, the only way I can really support that, if I'm trying to do value add multi, is focus on the cash flow play. Right. So my real business strategy has been identify properties we can get a lower average price per unit. Right. Say, for example, units in the area trade for 150. Like, I'm trying to get units for 110, 120. Right. And maybe it will take 10K per unit to get it to stabilization. So I'm all in maybe 125K a unit. They're worth 150. There's a whole bunch of refinance ability right there. And another key metric I look for when looking for opportunities is there's a huge delta between current rents and market rents and the tenants on month to month. Right? Because if there's a huge delta and I'm getting a lower price per unit, that means if I'm really good in operations and I can increase the cash flow of the property, there's a huge ability to refi the money out and provide principal back to my investors. So that's kind of been my bread and butter, and it has been very successful. And I have scaled very quickly by being very operationally efficient, sucking out equity from those properties to buy more properties.
Right. Now, how do you choose locations? Like, how do you determine which locations fit, which locations don't?
So, I mean, I think everybody says, you know, where are the deals, right? And that brings up a whole point, is like, to find deals, you really have to spread out your buy box, right? Like, I'm in Worcester, Massachusetts, the fastest growing city in New England. It was on the Redfin hot list for cities, right? So if I just stuck to Worcester, and I do own 30 units in Worcester, I like Worcester a lot, but if I just stuck to Worcester, I'd be sitting on my hands for 6 months before a deal came across my desk, right? So I spread out my area, right? And we end up buying, I think, 69 units in New Bedford, Massachusetts, which is an hour south of Boston. We got it for about 80K a unit. They were in good shape. They units trade for, you know, 100 to 120K a unit, right? Or Rhode Island. Providence, Rhode Island is a pretty close market to me as well. So I primarily focus on markets where there's a large concentration of multifamily, right? Because it's way easier to find a deal when there's a lot of that in stock. It's very hard to find a good multi if there's only one or two in the market at any given time.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, again, there is a such thing as a bad area, but regardless of that, I mean, obviously, more or less, you're going to pretty much figure out where the deals are. Like you said, multifamily in general, you can't go wrong. All right. So, like, with everything being said, I mean, not every area is a good area. Some areas are better than others. And what are the characteristics of those areas that you, pretty much choose? Like, what do you look at when you decide which area is right for you?
I mean, you're exactly correct. I mean, obviously, best case scenario, you're always going to choose the right area, the best area possible. But sometimes that is impossible. But if you do choose maybe not the best area, you might want to switch up your business strategy to accommodate that particular area. Like, I'll give you a quick example. Like, I own a 6-unit in Maine South in Worcester, Massachusetts. It's not the best area, but we got a fantastic price per unit. Three families around us sell for $650 right now. We got a 6-unit for $750,000. We got a really good price per unit. But like I said, it wasn't in the best area. So what did we do to negate that? We focused on Section 8 tenants. Those are the demographics that you really should specialize in, those kind of not best areas. And then the better areas, you want to kind of have, you know, specialize with those demographics like blue collar or white collar, depending on the area as well. So you want to match up your business plan to the demographic in the area, and which will really, you know, increase the likelihood of success.
Right. That makes sense. Now, the other thing that comes up is with the landlord and tenant board, you know, when people don't pay and all that. Like, prime example, I'm out of Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and our landlord and tenant board might as well be renamed as the tenant board, because there's almost no benefit to the landlord in any shape, way, or form. And that includes even when they're in the right. I mean, it's pretty much useless for landlords as far as I'm concerned, which is why I've had my realtor's license, and my message to everybody is do not buy in Ontario. And unless it's your home you're going to live in. And for investments, I think it's a terrible place, because if people stop paying, it takes 12 to 18 months to get them out. And try paying your mortgage when nobody's paying you. I don't know, but that's been my experience, and that's what I've been viewing. And, you know, and that's where I'm biased against. But there are places that are not as bad. There's some places that are what we call landlord friendly. There's some places that are not, but they're not so excruciating. What is your area like?
So we would definitely describe our area as tenant friendly. So, you know, if you are trying to get somebody out in Massachusetts, an eviction, normally it'd probably take you 3 to 6 months to do that, right? But the real investors that are truly successful in our particular market are the investors that try to create win-win scenarios for everybody and have a high level of emotional intelligence, right? So a lot of times I'll go in and I'll negotiate with between tenants using the binder strategy, you know, halfway between market and what they're paying, you know, and try to get them to agree to that rent and then propose a solution. Because if they propose a solution, it's a way higher likelihood they're going to follow through with that, right? Or maybe, for example, I do have to go through an eviction. It's going to take me 6 months to evict them. It makes more sense for me to just give them cash for keys, give them $2,000 to leave, than lose out on 6 months of vacancy where they're paying $2,000 and I essentially would be losing $12,000 in revenue in that particular period, right? So it's all about weighing the return on investment for that particular solution and not letting your principles get in the way. I know so many landlords that say, oh, they're not paying rent. I'm not going to give them any money. You're literally losing $10,000 more in this equation because your principles are standing in your way, right? So those are really the tenements that will really allow you to be successful in these tenant-friendly markets.
Yeah, see, your area is not actually that bad in comparison to here. Now, in Toronto, with this cash for keys, I mean, this is not a new concept. It's there, and it can be a lucrative, way to get them out there. Like, well, not lucrative, I mean, but a way to save, major pain down the road. But in Toronto, tenants have gotten wind of how bad it is with the tenant board. And what ends up happening is now you offer that $2,000 and they're saying, I'm not leaving unless you give me $10,000. And then once they caught wind that you're going to evict them, they stop paying rent. It ends up being whatever reason you want them to leave, whether any reason, they ended up making it worse than where it is. Because now even if they went from being late to paying every second month, they're going to purposely stop paying, knowing that you're going to the tenant board, figuring that by the time you get to them is 12 to 14 months later. At that point in time, it's been hardship for you, and they've gotten away with 14 months of rent of not paying rent at all. And, you know, I mean, again, that's always one of those, you give a person an inch, they take a foot. But again, that's where I am. And that's not everybody. I'm just giving you certain circumstances that I've come across, right? So there's like, I find that most people, for the most part, are generally good people. if something goes wrong, typically it's really just an unfortunate circumstance. It's not necessarily that they're out to, you know, hurt you or do damage or anything like that. Sometimes stuff happens in life, right? And you just got to deal with that. Sometimes that $2,000 you're saying, even though you're trying to do it to avoid headaches, sometimes you actually end up being that tenant's savior, because that $2,000, they could have lost their job. They need to move out. They want to go back to their parents, but they don't want to break the lease because it's a lease, but they don't know how to pay you either. You offer them that $2,000 and they're out the door. Sometimes that's the bump they need. And sometimes that's just working with them. You never know. Everybody's situation is different. And now my extreme situation was obviously for a small percentage of people, but they leave a really bad taste in people's mouth when they do that. So, but anyways, you know, it's interesting that I think your strategy is great and your wait times are that bad, so it becomes a very you know, it comes ideal for them to take the $2,000. Now where I'm going with this is, why do you choose areas that are not landlord friendly versus just going to a state that pretty much is landlord friendly?
So I do own out of state. I do own a 32 unit in Lancaster, South Carolina. But the reason why I invest locally is because control and operations. I'm a certified project manager. I still have my W-2. I'm still a project manager by trade. And my strength lies in performance efficiency, right? So if I can drive to the property, if I can get my hands on it, there's a way high likelihood that I'm going to be able to stabilize the property that much quicker, create that forced appreciation, create that forced equity, and be able to scoop it out, right? So that's kind of why I invest locally, is for operational efficiency. And I mean, you know, a year of lost rent, that's brutal. Like, Massachusetts is known for being extremely tenant friendly in regards to the United States. I think maybe California is like worse, but there's not many more states that's worse than that. But like, you have a real bad. You have a real, real bad. I'm not gonna lie. What I would say is, you know, there's always, people are still making money in your market, right? So what does that mean? It's like, maybe that means like during the due diligence process of getting your property under contract, you do more due diligence on the tenant and as opposed to me, where I'm doing a lot of on the building. Like, you probably should do background checks on every single tenant, you know, see if they have any evictions, ask for their history, show me bank statements showing that they paid rent the past 10 months. Like, if I was in your situation, that's how I would be probably tackling that challenge, to be honest with you, or I'd be investing out of state.
Absolutely. Now, that's the thing. It's up till now, the landlords have no access to people's credit scores in the way that they don't report. What's coming in now, which will help, I think it'll help, is that the ability for landlords to report to the credit bureau. That'll be an incentive for the tenant to want to pay the landlord and pay on time, because the credit bureau is going to be, reflect that. So even if they're trying to improve their credit because their credit's bad, that will be a way for them to improve. Because before, if they made all their payments, there was no benefit to the tenant other than the fact that they're living there. Like, for them to feel excited about being on time. And now that it can help repair their credit, that might be an incentive for them to not venture out. So I think stuff like that is great. Plus, the ability of them to be able to report. We already check credit scores, but aside from that, is that there's technology coming out where landlords are able to report their experience with you in certain apps or websites or stuff like that. So as that builds out, there'll be more opportunities for other landlords to search a person out through those, you know, apps and websites, so they can kind of see what, you know, the history, and not rely on the tenant's version of it. So there's things that's being done that will be helpful. And you said it right. Vetting is the most important part. And it's funny, because now that landlords have been burned so much, the ones that are remaining are vetting like crazy, to the point that people are complaining, saying, I can't get approved. I can't find a place. And you've seen people being vocal about that. And, you know, I don't want to say it, but it's like, yeah, maybe just because you didn't do so good with your credit, your track history might not be so good. And maybe people don't want to take a chance on you because of that. So history kind of caught up to you. But I mean, I'm not going to go out there and I'm going to mind my business. But that's essentially what, you know, the real reply. But where I'm going with this is also that, look, as a realtor, I see a lot of things out there and I see a lot of stats. Right now, a lot of the homes and stuff that are on the market, 60% of our listings in Ontario or in Toronto are investors cashing out saying that I'm either done with the investing here or and I'm going to go somewhere else, or I'm just going to put my money elsewhere, period. That's quite a high number. That means that's a lot of people taking rental units out of the market. So it's, again, it goes to prove that if something's tenant friendly, it's not always a good thing. And if it's extreme the way we are, this is the result. This is what happens. I mean, like, you got government complaining, but reality is you're not going to dictate the mom and pop guy who's relying on these rents and tell them how to run their business and let themselves go bankrupt because they can't make their payments because their tenant is protected.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, money goes where money is treated well. It doesn't sound like money's being treated well where you're at, so it's leaving. And it's going to better places where it will be treated well.
Absolutely. Like, our popular transition is take it out of Ontario and move it over to the Sunshine State, also known as Florida, right? That's the common one that I hear. I mean, I'm sure it's not the only one, but it's the common one I hear.
Yeah.
Awesome. Now, with this being said, like, you get into multifamily and that. Do you do anything aside from the apartments? Do you guys, like, self-storage? That's another common thing I keep hearing.
So I think the people that do too much are average in a bunch of things. And I try to be great in one thing. So I have complete blinders on, and I specifically focus on value add multi. People talk about, why don't you get a short-term rental? Why don't you do self-storage? Why don't you do retail? Why don't you do industrial? Because that would take thousands and thousands and thousands of hours for me to become amazing at that. I'd rather focus on what I've made my wealth in and really go all in, you know, an inch wide, a mile deep. And that's been my philosophy, and it's treated me extremely well. Over the past 3 years, I don't know, I think I like 8x my net worth, right? So multifamily is my bread and butter, and I am not skewing from that. And I am not being, I don't have shiny object syndrome. I know what I'm good at, and I am staying in my lane.
Love that answer. And that's, I believe the same thing. I believe you're better off to be great at something than to be, you know, average at everything. So that's awesome. Going forward, like, what has been your biggest challenges so far?
I would say my biggest challenge is my time. Currently, I do a lot of roles. I still have my W-2 job as a project manager at a biotech company. I'm an investor-focused agent. I got 3 agents under me. I self-manage 30 units. I own 130 units. I'm a GP in a couple syndications. I host 2 meetups, right? So I am running sparse on time. And at a certain point, something's got to break. I either got to kind of leave my W-2, go on the real estate. Me and my partner are in the process of expanding our team, hiring a project manager, hiring executive assistant. We already have virtual assistants in place. I'm an assistant property manager. But that's really been my challenge, is balancing my attention, because I built all these bridges, and don't get me wrong, all of them are synergistic and they all feed into each other. Even my W-2 makes me loanable to a bank, right? I get better debt than most people because I have that W-2. But at a certain point, I have so much momentum that it just doesn't make sense anymore for me. And that's kind of the challenges I'm facing currently.
Yeah, absolutely. I get it. Now, a lot of times people don't want to get into real estate or get into mass amounts of real estate because they don't want to manage it, right? I mean, let's be honest. Obviously, managing it for you, you got a knack for it. But for many people, it's like they want to put their money somewhere, but they don't really want the tenants calling them. Now, right or wrong, let's not get into that. Let's get more to the point that sometimes people are too busy. Sometimes it goes back to what you said, focusing on what you're really good at. Like, some people have executive roles, and having that executive role, they're very good at what they do. Hence the reason they got the executive role. They don't want to be, distracted by, leaky faucets and, flooded basements or anything like that. So now what it comes down to is, now the rumor out there, or the buzz out there, is that if I have to get a property manager, then I'm losing my profits. Like, how does it work? And I know there's a certain knack with going to multifamily because it gives you more options. Maybe let's break that down.
Sure. So in real estate, money is made in the management. A great deal could turn bad if it's managed poorly. A okay deal could turn great if it's managed well, right? So to your point, you know, you have a couple of different options with that, right? You could hire a team internally, have a couple virtual assistants, have like a property manager that you hire internally to manage your properties. You could also hire a third-party property manager. But what I'll be honest with you, most property managers don't care about the property the way you do, and they don't manage it to the way you do. And a lot of times it does suck up your profit if they're not, you know, vetting contractors, if they're not getting three quotes for everything, if they're not, you know, on top of everything, it could suck up all your profits. Like, or, I mean, the other option is to put your money with an experienced investor like myself. I mean, a lot of people who invest with me have those high paying W-2s and don't have the time to do it, right? And I, me and my partner, we have the team in place to manage these properties to sufficiency. So there's a couple different options in how you can do it. I think the wrong answer is to not invest in real estate. I think real estate is the best wealth building asset class in the world. I think the question is, how are you going to do it?
Yes, absolutely. What do you think of in terms of, I don't want to say syndication, maybe it's a syndication that I'm thinking of. It's having, where you're investing in real estate companies that, you know, basically it's almost like you're buying, you know, stock shares into the company. Mm-hmm. I think you know what I'm talking about. I think it's called syndication.
I am a GP in a syndication in New Bedford, Massachusetts, yes.
What do you think of that? I mean, let's be honest. Those aren't going to pay the same as you owning the property itself. But in a sense, it's risk-free. And what I mean by risk-free is not that there's no possibility to lose money because, you know, markets go up and down. You're leaving the control into somebody else's hands. So anything could happen. But it's risk-free in the way that the leaky faucets and the toilets and all that stuff really is not your problem. It really is a cash investment.
When it comes to syndications, it's all about the operator. The operator is the most important factor when it comes to the success or the failure of a syndication. Then comes the deal, then comes the market, right? So when you're investing in syndications, they are a fantastic tool to get involved in real estate and be passive. And you're essentially giving a piece of the pie, maybe you're giving 20%, maybe you're giving 30%, maybe you're giving 40% of the upside away for somebody else to do the hard work associated with that. But there's no if ands or buts about it. Managing a large syndication is a lot of work for a syndicator. And as a syndicator, a lot of times you don't make money unless your investors make money. A lot of times as a syndicator, you only participate in the upside. It's how you structure the deal. But I would always recommend, if you are going to invest in a syndicator and a syndication, make sure your incentives are aligned. Right? Make sure there aren't a ton of acquisition fees. Make sure there aren't a ton of asset management fees. Make sure your syndicator only makes money when you make money, right? I think that's the key when investing in these syndications. And like I said, the utmost important factor is the syndicator, the fact they have a track record, the fact that they've invested in real estate themselves before getting involved in these larger properties. I think that's some of the most important factors.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of good syndications out there and there's a lot of bad ones out there. Now, you mentioned some of the ways to find out which ones are good and bad. But also, how do you check on the reputation? How do you get that information? I'm assuming, like, do you ask them for some form of, you know, like financials or something? Like what's the opportunity here?
You could ask for some prior deals, right? Going over the numbers of prior deals. You could ask for some prior investors' contact information to have conversations with them. You know, you can post on forums to see if other people have had good experiences with this syndication company. You know, there's a ton of different ways on how to do it, for sure. I think, you know, word of mouth and referrals is probably one of the best way to figure that out, in my opinion. And that, honestly, that's how I find most of my vendors and contractors, is through, you know, other successful investors in my area. Who do they use, right? And that's honestly how I find some of my best teammates.
Absolutely. So, which brings up the good point here that, you know what I mean, like, people sometimes want to do everything on their own, and you're just proving the point that sometimes you could do much bigger things and have a better outcome by learning to collaborate. I think collaboration is the key to real growth.
Yeah, I mean, and you bring up a really good point, is like, a lot of people ask me, how did I scale to 130 units in 3 years? It's because I surrounded myself with other people who own hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of units. Right when I got into real estate, after I made it up to maybe 3 or 6 units, I ended up finding a mentor who owned hundreds of units in the area. And rather than me asking him to be my mentor, I found ways to provide value to him, right? He hosts meetups all over Massachusetts. So I helped him start a meetup in Worcester, Massachusetts. He owns a brokerage, right? So I became an investor-focused agent, learned under him, and provided him value in the form of commissions. And then when I actually had deals under contract, he was a call away. And any issue I came across, 2-minute conversation. It may take me days to figure it out, or I could just call this guy and answer my question in 2 minutes. Additionally, I see what he does on a daily basis, and I can emulate that. It's more or less copy and paste, right? So if you're really trying to grow in real estate, you're really going to want to surround yourself around people doing what you want to do at a larger scale.
Awesome. Awesome. Now, let's break down the numbers, right? Because there's good deals and bad deals. And everyone's trying to outdo each other. And the reality is that sometimes you can be in an offer situation where you can outdo the person that you're competing with, or you can even get a better rate than you got from the guy who bought the unit next door. But the problem is, just because you got a better rate from the one next door doesn't mean you got a good deal, because it's possible that he overpaid as well. So how do you determine what numbers work, what doesn't work? Like, what's the process to figure that out?
So I specifically focus in value add multifamily, and me and my partner, we like properties that are in relatively good shape with that are operationally inefficient. And there's a large delta between current rents and market rents, right? And what I really look for when seeing if a deal even makes sense before I even underwrite, my main factor is cash on cash return. I could care less about cap rates. I want to know, what is the yield on my money? If the cash on cash return is great, the cap rate will work itself out, in my opinion. And I primarily look, are you familiar with the 1% rule?
1%. Yes, I've heard it before.
Okay.
But maybe for people watching, let's break it down.
So the 1% rule is 1% of the purchase price equals the monthly rent. So if you get a property for $100,000, the monthly rent should equal $1,000. That is the 1% rule, right? When I look for properties, I look for things where the pro forma rent or the market rents are near the 1.2, 1.3% rule. That's a quick indicator to me if it makes sense. And that's literally just back of the napkin math that I know a deal makes sense before even having to go deep into the underwriting process. So that's kind of what I look for in my deals, is I look for good price per units. Like, you know, you can look up comparable sales in the area and see where things are selling at a per unit basis. And then if you're getting, you know, a 20% discount on that unit, I mean, most likely it's a good deal. And I look for that nice delta between the cash on cash return to allow upside for me and my investors.
Awesome. Now, not everybody's 100%, right? So have you ever made a bad deal, like where you purchased something and you thought, going in, I thought it was going to be a better deal than it actually was?
Yes. So I ended up purchasing this 3-family in Worcester, Massachusetts. Me and my partner split it 50-50. We brought 50% of the cash. And by all accounts, it looked like it was great. I think we got it for $497,000. Pro forma rents were around $5,500 per month. So like I said, it kind of was above the 1% rule, right? And the property was in good shape. So by all accounts, it looked like a good deal. However, once we owned the property, we got riddled and riddled and riddled with repairs. At one point, I think asbestos was identified in the basement, and we had to spend $4,000 to get rid of, I think, a trash bag full of asbestos. It was such a small amount, yet it cost us a lot of money. Additionally, the tenant base was rough. Like, they would really ruin our unit. And they were all Section 8 tenants. And if you know anything about Section 8 tenants, they have an annual inspection, and Section 8 always gives you a list of items to fix, right? So if we have these tenants that ruin our unit day in and day out, and Section 8 comes in and I'm like, we're not going to pay you rent until you fix all these things that your tenant broke, eats up all of our cash on cash return, right? So this particular deal, I think, like, I've owned it for over a year and a half. We're like break even on it. What I will say is, thankfully, the property did appreciate and is probably worth around $625. So we do have some equity in there, but from a return standpoint, it hasn't provided me much return.
Awesome. Now, going forward, what is your objective for, like, say, in the next 5 years? Like, where do you see yourself going compared to, because, you know, look, where we start off and where we think we're going and where we end up are usually different places. But now, as we get experience and we have more, you know, equity, more capital, more vision, sometimes we change directions. And I don't mean change landscape, I mean in terms of what you do. But sometimes, you know, if you plan to just say, like, people sometimes look at, you know, units that are 4 at a time, 20 at a time, then, you know, eventually you grow and now all of a sudden you're looking at 200 unit apartments or more. What does your next five years look like? What is your objective and goal?
So I'm part of GoBundance, and one of the big things when it comes to GoBundance is living a full-bodied life. So I have goals, but they're all not financial, right? Like, one of my 10-year goals is I want to own a house on a beach, right, that I could meditate every single day. I want to own a house in a mountain where I could ski on a regular basis. I want to travel to 100 countries. I want to help 10,000 people reach financial independence. Like, I want to write a book and share value to the world. But in regards to my investing and my financial goals, my goal is probably around, I want in 10 years, I want to get up to around 10,000 units, and I want to actively own 400 units myself. That's kind of my 10-year vision.
Awesome. Now, what would your advice be to a possible investor, you know, who's pretty much got a job, just they got their job, it's paying 70 grand a year. They don't think they're making enough to get into the market. They're kind of scared because it's their first time and they don't know where to start or what to do. What would that process look like for them?
So wealth building is all about a good offense, but also a good defense, right? And my advice to them would be first tackle your expense. And the way you can do that is house hack a property, right? Find a 3 or 4plex, live in one unit, get some roommates, rent out the other two, get your living expenses as close to zero as possible. If you can do that, that's 70 grand. You got to be able to save 50, 60, 70% of that money, and your wealth building journey is going to happen that much quicker. Additionally, when it comes to the offense side, you got to get out of the scarcity mindset and the saving mindset, and you really have to get into the investing mindset. You're not going to save yourself to financial freedom. It's absolutely impossible. You think making 7% in stock is really going to get you there? It absolutely will not. So you really have to like get in the investing mindset. Then once you kind of get your expenses to as close to zero as possible, think, how can I really invest this money in the best way possible to get me to that financial freedom number, would be my advice.
Awesome. That's amazing. All right. So I'm going to get into a couple more questions before I go into what I call the lightning round. And the second last question is going to be, how do you know you've had a successful day?
The way I know I had a successful day is I normally do my miracle morning on a daily basis. I don't know if your audience is familiar with that, but it's a morning routine where essentially you do the six most, the most successful people in the world have these daily habits. S for silence or meditation, A for affirmation, V for visualization, E for exercise, R for reading, S for scribing, and it's the acronym SAVERS. Or journaling. And when I do, I journal, you know, what is my 1 year, 5 year, 10 year goal? And what can I do today to get me closer to that goal? And if that list is done by the end of the day, I feel great. That's how I know I had a successful day. And a lot of times it just breaks out to two or three tasks, maybe 10, 15 minutes, right? But you really have to identify the real KPIs that push your goals forward and take action on those goals.
Love that. Awesome. So the last question, but not least, is if people are looking out for you or looking to find you, where would they go?
Thank you for that. So they can find me on Instagram at Investor Freed. They can also find me on LinkedIn and Facebook at Andrew Freed. Reach out. I'm always happy to provide value to others. And yeah.
Fantastic. All right, let's get into the lightning round, which is just some fun questions about you personally, such as question number one, which is going to be, what is your favorite food and why?
So recently, I actually quit. I quit everything. I quit alcohol. I quit weed. I quit coffee. I quit sugar. And I feel absolutely amazing. So that's been a big change in my life. Prior to that, I think my vice was food. I would eat whatever I wanted. but I would say my favorite food is like a nice protein, like a nice salmon or a nice steak with some vegetables.
Love it. Awesome. Favorite travel destination and why?
My favorite travel destination, I haven't been there yet. I do want to visit Tokyo, Japan. I just absolutely love the culture. I have been to Vietnam, and one of the absolute best places I've been in my entire life was Ha Long Bay, which is one of the seven natural wonders of the world. And it literally looked like a screensaver. It's the most beautiful scene you could possibly imagine. And then me and my family, we rented a hotel boat on the water, and we stayed there over a couple nights. And it was one of the best times of my life.
Love it. All right. So, next question is going to be, what is your favorite book and or podcast?
I would say one of my recent favorite books, because I'm always reading, is probably Limitless by Jim Quick.
Yes.
So Jim Quick's all about teaching people how to learn and be the best learners that they possibly can. And that book really teaches you on how to be a high performer. And I've taken a lot of those daily recommendations and I've incorporated them in my life. And they've really helped me kind of move to the next level and really increase my performance. So I highly recommend that book. It's a fantastic book, and don't just read it, study it.
Love that. Now, typically we all have somebody that out there in general, we grow up and we come across, whether we meet them or not, we find them as an inspiration or a mentor in some form, whether it's mentoring through just consuming their content or whether it's mentoring because they actually know you and mentor you. Who would be your biggest inspiration or motivator?
So I think this goes back to my original mentor that owned hundreds of units and really took him under my wing. And his name is John Bambachi. He's a big investor in my area. I think he owns around 500 units, the head of my brokerage. And I just really appreciate and I'm grateful for the fact that he took me under his wing. He took the time to train me. And that syndication that I ended up doing, I think 2 or 3 weeks before we closed and we were running short on capital, he came in, he saved the day. So I'm incredibly thankful for him. I wouldn't be where I'm at without his support. And yeah, I mean, I think everybody should try to find a mentor like John.
Absolutely. All right. Last but not least, if you were given unlimited amount of money, but only 48 hours to spend it, what you spend, you get to keep. What you don't spend gets taken away. What would you do?
I would buy as much real estate as I possibly could with cash. What else would I want to do? Awesome. Yeah. And I mean, the great thing about that is you buy it with cash. You can do a cash start refi. And it's all tax-free money. Debt is tax-free.
Yeah, you brought up that point, right? That's the best way to do it. Like, the benefit of refinancing is you're keeping a debt in the property, which means you keep the equity that's in there, because you have to have a minimum of 20% when it comes to investing. It's not like a regular home that you buy to live in where you can do it with 5%. And the point I'm getting at is that you get your money out, and therefore, when you do sell, you minimize the amount of taxes that you get if you ever sell. So love that. Awesome. All right. I want to say, Andrew, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Absolutely. If you like what you saw and you want to see some more, subscribe to the link below. Thanks for tuning in to the Investors Outlook podcast.